Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When it comes to sports today, women are everywhere on the field as players and coaches, in the front office, in the press box, on TV covering the games, and yes, in the locker rooms getting the latest on whatever game just took place. But it wasn't always this way. Long before the WNBA and other women's teams were taking the spotlight, when that light was focused singularly on men's athletics, women were working hard to break in, among them sports journalists who needed the same access male reporters had in order to do their jobs. It took pioneers willing to endure backlash from those trying to keep them out, pioneers willing to scale the walls that were already there or being erected to keep them out, pioneers willing to be in that struggle for the long haul and ready for the moment when the impossible would happen. One of those pioneers is our guest this hour. Melissa Luttke was 26 years old and writing for Sports Illustrated when in 1977, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bowie Kuhn barred her from entering the locker room following the New York Yankees' victory in the World Series. At the time, she was the only woman involved full-time in sports writing, and she was the only reporter barred from the locker room, even though the teams had given her the go-ahead. What followed was a groundbreaking gender discrimination court case against the league, which made headlines around the world. It was a fight that would eventually change everything. But when you're in the middle of that kind of fight, it's just plain hard. Well, now Melissa Luttke is sharing that experience in her book at long last, Locker Room Talk, A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside, and she joins us for the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Mike. What an introduction. It certainly takes me back to those days. And I look at myself and I say, yeah, I'm still alive, still here, and actually smiling. So you do get through. You do get through, even when you have to go back and relive it in order to write a book like I've just done. I just want to correct one thing very quickly, and that is that my book revolves around my work as a baseball reporter, baseball writer at Sports Illustrated. And I was not certainly the only woman sports writer at the time. What I do say is that I was the only woman covering Major League Baseball full time nationally at that time. And I did that because I was with a national magazine. There were women, although few of us, a pioneering class, if you will, who were sort of entering the ranks of being sports writers. We weren't on air yet, but as sports writers. But most of those women at that time were assigned by sports editors to what were considered the lesser two sports. And I know that for people who love Michael Jordan here and the rest, they're not going to believe it, but the NBA was a rather small minor league back in the 70s. So women were assigned to the NHL and the NBA. So what happened to me is I ended up on baseball. And baseball was very different. So I ended up as the lone woman in a sea of men. In a sport that was incredibly conservative and thought of itself sort of a higher god, if you will, among the leagues.
And it still was. In the 70s, baseball was still kind of the king. It was beginning to slip a little bit, leaving its, I guess, stepping aside a bit for the NFL. NFL eventually became America's big sport. But back then, baseball was still hanging on, and the World Series was the event to cover. But let's go back to those years. A lot of people listening right now weren't alive in the 70s. And a lot of people who were alive in the 70s, if they're like me, have forgotten most of it. So let's go.
And they're amazed that we are still alive.
That's so go right. ahead. So you were there at Sports Illustrated in New York City covering Major League Baseball. But what makes it more important to me is that you were 26 years old. How the heck did that happen for you? How do you end up at Sports Illustrated, which was a major magazine back in the day when magazines were important, covering Major League Baseball in the number one city in the country?
Okay, well, we have to go back a little bit, and I'll try not to draw the story out. But it happened one night when I had just graduated from college. I graduated from a liberal arts college that had no journalism courses. I never worked on the school newspaper. So going into journalism itself and sports journalism would have been the last thing people would have thought from a person who majored in art history. So I was floundering after graduation. And then I was invited one evening to come to a dinner, and across the dinner table from me was Frank Gifford. People may remember him for a variety of things, probably as Kathie Lee Gifford's husband,
Right.
most likely among young people. But at that time, he had just come from being the matinee idol, an NFL star in New York, to becoming a broadcaster. He was on the first team of broadcasters, Howard Cosell, Dandy Don Meredith, and Frank Gifford with Monday Night Football. I sat across from him at this dinner table, and for 2 hours, did nothing but talk sports with him. I love talking sports. I'd played sports as a kid. My father took me to football games, my mother to baseball games. I could talk the talk. And so at the end of dinner, Frank gave me what I thought was a great compliment. I was 21 years old, and he said, "You know, for a girl, you know a lot about sports." I said, "Oh my God, I mean, this man." And then he followed it up and he said, "You know, if you come to New York," and I'd never been to New York on my own, "if when you come to New York, I'd be happy to introduce you people at Sports at ABC Sports." So 5 weeks later, just a week after the Battle of the Sexes was played, with Billie Jean King defeating Bobby Riggs, you know, big time for women to break forward in sports, I pull into the garage under ABC's headquarters. Frank is a man of his word, takes me all around, and the last office that he leaves me in before he has to go do the local broadcast is the only woman producer at ABC Sports. She has no windows in her office. That's how we know she is the woman producer there. So she talks to me, and then she gives me an invitation of a lifetime. She says, "Why don't you stick around?" She said, "They've assigned me to do a women in sports special. I've got an all-women's crew. And because Title IX had been passed and Billie Jean King had just beat Bobby Riggs." So I extended my stay and I joined her and her all-women crew in a little studio a couple streets up the block. And here's where the deal was sealed. I didn't know how I would do it, but the deal was sealed when Billie Jean King walked up the stairs and into that studio and stood in front of me. And I said, "This is my life." I just saw it ahead of me. The vision opened up. And I said, "I don't have any credentials to do this. I don't know how I'll do it." But by January of that year, I had moved to New York. I'd moved into an apartment with the production assistant for Ellie Rieger. She held the keys to the kingdom. That was a mimeographed set of papers that told me every month what ABC Sports was doing, not only in the shoots on weekends, but during the week, I could go over to the studios. They do the video layovers and stuff. And so I became just a sort of appendage to ABC Sports. I would go and be a secretary during the day to pay the rent. And then, this is going to bring us to SI, one day, 5 months into this sort of, you know, sitting in these studios every night, getting to know the directors and producers, one of them said to me, "You know, I know the guy who hires over at Sports Illustrated for entry-level jobs. Do you want an interview? Do you want me to introduce you?" "What do you think I said?" "Of course, yes." Got rejected the first time. And then, you know, through a series of staying in touch, 3 months later, I got a call. He brought me in again, interviewed me again, and hired me. I mean, it was
Had you
no,
written anything?
I had no clip files. I had not one clip. You know, I'm staying in Charlotte with a friend of mine who's a baseball writer. You know, of course, he followed the traditional path there. He worked for, you know, UNC's newspaper, you know, the Daily Tar Heel. He had clips up the kazoo. Everyone who applied for these precious, precious jobs had dreamed of this forever. So, you know, I think that it was just, I wrote postcards all summer after I got rejected from all of the sites I went to with ABC Sports. And I wasn't telling fibs, but, you know, he kept getting these postcards from me. And I would say, "Hey, I'm working at the US Open. I'm in the 18th broadcast booth with Henry Longhurst." And then I'd be at the US Open at Forest Hills. I sent him postcards. So when it came time for him to interview, what would you do, Mike? You've got a pile of resumes, all have clip files, 2 inches deep, right? They all read the same, right? It's like sending it to Indeed today with all the keywords, the algorithms all look the same. And then you've got this stray resume on your desk in the corner. You got a pile of postcards on it. And you think, okay, I'll pull that one. That's easier. Yeah. And so I got in the office. I made an impression, I guess, in my second interview, and he hired me.
And it's a curiosity. I mean, you've got this pile of similar resumes, yeah. And you've got one that's completely out of the box.
And he doesn't know how it's there.
I got 30 minutes. Let's talk to this woman. Let's see what this is about.
That's exactly right.
And yet, I mean, yes, a lot of this was luck and serendipity for you, but you seem to be a natural. And it's, I think it might be in your DNA because it goes back to your grandfather. I think in the book you write about how the day you were born, your grandfather wrote
a
letter.
Here's the letter, Mike. Here's the actual typed letter and the envelope that my grandfather sent this letter in. Yes, yes. Go ahead.
He wrote a letter to your mom because it was you were born, and he spent I think 5 words on the fact that here you are, and then he goes off into this tangent about baseball.
Well, you know, you had to wonder because when my mom died in 2011, I found this letter among everything she'd kept when I was born. She was in Iowa. She'd married a boy from Iowa who she'd met at the end of World War II. They'd both gone back to the University of Iowa to get their degrees. My mother, her master's, my father, his PhD. And I was born about a week before they got their degrees. So her father was back near Boston, where she had grown up as his seatmate at Fenway Park. Fourth of four children, the one who gravitated toward baseball and just had a bond with her father. She would score every game when they went away on the road. She had pictures she'd put around the corners of her bedroom so the Red Sox were staring down at her. She clipped all the 4 newspapers or 5 newspapers every morning. She made a scrapbook. She had the DNA. And so you're right, when I found this letter, I said to myself, my God, I was probably born to do this because you're right. I looked at the postmark. It took him 4 days. After I was born to write the letter. But when you read the letter, you find out why. Because the New York Yankees were on a train on the day I was born, headed for their first May series with the Red Sox that year. And so they had 3 games to play. Well, he couldn't sit at his typewriter while the Red Sox were in town. I mean, this was too exciting. So instead, he waits until the series is over. And the Red Sox have won the series 3-0. The Yankees have left town, and he sits down to write my mother a letter after she has her first of 5 children, and that's me. He spells my name wrong, assures her that I will be a sweet girl, and then he does a play-by-play of the games for her in this letter. I mean, there was no digital. She couldn't hear it on the radio. This was her first inkling, I'm sure, that the Yankees had played. And so I read this letter, and as I write in my book, you're right. I just looked at this letter and said, my God. And I said, but think about it. 1951, there's no way that in 1951, my mother, my grandfather, anyone could have imagined that even if I had the DNA in me, that I could have done what I ended up doing with it.
And that's what I want to, we're going to spend some time in the next segment talking about, because although your story makes it sound like you kind of dropped into Sports Illustrated, easy peasy, it wasn't really that easy. And if it was, getting there was the easy part. Right. Staying there, putting up with what you had to put up with well before this court case, and then after the court case, was the hard part. And that is the crux of A Locker Room Talk, which is the book by our guest today, Melissa Ludke, A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside. It may seem like ancient history to young people today, but this woman is a pioneer who made your job much easier. We're going to come back and talk about that and more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Melissa Luttke, who is the author of Locker Room Talk, A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside. She was at Sports Illustrated in 1977 as the only female full-time baseball writer on staff and probably anywhere in the country, covering the World Series. For those who don't remember, that was an important World Series, which we will talk about. And she was given access to the locker room by the teams and then shut out by Bowie Kuhn, who was the baseball commissioner. And the court case that resulted from that broke down barriers that to this day are allowing women to get ahead in that field and many others. By the way, Melissa Luttke will be at Park Road Books tonight to discuss her new book beginning at 6:30, Park Road Books in the Park Road Shopping Center. So we were talking about how you got Sports Illustrated and the fact that getting there seems easy, probably wasn't as easy as you make it out to be, but staying there and dealing with stuff along the way was hard. You were a pioneer. There were no instructions to what you were trying to accomplish here. You write, when I showed up at ballparks, I found no roadmap to use. I relied on my gut, blown like the weather vane atop a church steeple. I moved as the men around me did. If they were near the batting cage, so was I. When I saw them head to the dugout, I followed. It didn't occur to me to ask anyone on our baseball reporting team at Sports Illustrated for advice, nor was any offered. I want to talk about that. Nor did I find any mentors at the ballpark. In time, a few male writers befriended me, but when I first showed up, I was on my own. That sounds both frightening and lonely to me, but your gut instincts worked. But when you say you didn't seek out mentors, nor was any advice offered, was that because they really didn't want you there?
Oh, the men didn't want me there, that's for sure. And they couldn't have been the mentors for me because I had a different role. You know, when I approached a ball player, the ball player didn't know what to make of me either. So I had to be very clear as I came to understand by doing the kind of mimicking act I did of the men, because I had to learn from them. I had never been at a ball game in order to cover it before, so I didn't even know the etiquette around it. I had to learn from them when you approach a ball player at the batting cage. You had to learn which ball players were unapproachable, which ones you could speak to. You had to learn, and I had to learn, what if a ball player kind of brushes you off after a question is asked? Do you try to come back at that point? I had to learn all of the sort of intricacies of it, but then I had to put the overlay on it of being a woman doing that same dance with a ball player, because I had to be sure that if I approached a ball player and asked a question, that in that question I conveyed two things. One, I knew about him and I knew about the game. I had to indicate that in my question. I had to also be clear in my question that it wasn't a sort of flirtatious question. It was a serious question, but also that there was at least an openness to sort of humor, because there was obviously going to be a need for them to adjust to me as there was for me to adjust to my new surroundings. So there was a careful dance. And so I mentioned that I didn't have any journalism experience when I got to SI. By the time I became the baseball reporter, I'd been there for about almost a year and a half when I took over on the baseball beat as a reporter. And so I had been in maybe my first two semesters of graduate school of journalism at that point, but I'd never been out covering a sport because they had assigned me to the TV radio column because they thought I knew a lot about broadcasting because I'd come from being a gopher at ABC Sports. So going to baseball, that was the first time I'd actually ever been out covering a sport. So I had a lot to learn, and I was smart enough in a way looking back to know that I had a lot to learn, and I had my teachers there, even if they didn't want me in their classroom.
And that explains a lot, because it seems, if you talk about, they didn't offer any suggestions. No. About anything. This is Sports Illustrated. They've hired somebody who has no writing experience, and after a year and a half, they say, okay, you're going to cover Major League Baseball in New York City. You're going to cover the Yankees, you're going to cover the Mets, and ultimately you're going to cover the World Series. It would seem to me that that would put them in danger if you didn't know anything about how to do this, and they just threw you in, sink or swim.
But they knew I knew a lot about baseball. I'd proven
All right.
myself by doing the grunt work in the office.
But
That's how I proved myself to them.
you write about, you
Yeah.
told ABC's Jonathan Karl on
Yes.
This Week. You said that at the time, men, particularly older, curmudgeonly men, were just so frightened that they let one woman in the door of baseball, that it was going to be the end of the boys' club, the end of something that was treasured in that sport. Surely Sports Illustrated understood this. They were a boys' club for the most part. So I'm just curious as to why they
Well,
didn't
they may have
help
been
you
a
more.
boys' club, Mike, but I don't know that they had the self-awareness of what that
Ah.
implied to the women who were trying to be among them. I'm not sure at all that they had an awareness of what that meant to those who were on the outside of that boys' club. Remember the little girls who used to run toward maybe the boys' treehouse, and as soon as they got near, they'd pull the ladder up. They didn't want those girls up there. Forget it. That's kind of how it was with baseball. And I want to be clear, just so your listeners know, at the time, myself and other women who were hired as reporter researchers at that magazine, it's not like a newspaper. My paycheck every 2 weeks was not for me being at the ballpark. That was something I added after I had done my job during the day. I was given the passes to all American League and National League things. So I determined that I would be up there. I wasn't paid to be there. That wasn't part of my job. My job was to fact check the stories that the male writers turned in. I was the one who was the sort of accuracy girl, on the beat. So that wasn't part of my job. But because I came of age in a generation where you had the Gloria Steinems, the Bella Abzugs, the women's movement, who had basically said to my generation, we've opened the field. Now you take the ball and you run it down. So people who came in, and when I did, came in with the ambition of not remaining as a fact checker the rest of our careers at Sports Illustrated. The magazine was loaded with women who did nothing but fact check stories, stay in the office, come in at 9, leave at 5:30, whatever, fact check stories, and that was okay. They just had come of age in a different time. I had the ambition. And so I went up to the field every night to learn how to do this so I could learn to write the baseball stories, which I learned to do. I got baseball stories published in the magazine. But it took me, I basically gave up my dating life, during those years of my 20s, because all I did was take the subway up to the stadium every night. I'd take the subway home at like 11:30 midnight on my own. That was just, that made me happy. That's what I wanted to do. I
Well,
wanted to learn it.
you did something that I think a lot of successful people do. They love what they do. They love what they want to do.
Absolutely.
They have ambitions. They have goals, and they're willing to sacrifice to get to where they want to go. They may never achieve it, but by God, they're going to die trying. And
That's right.
that sounds very much like what you were talking about in the book. You talk about, and you talked about this morning, building relationships with the teams that you covered in New York, the Mets and the Yankees. Women sports writers were a novelty. Anybody who watched sports television or games on television where women first were allowed to be part of the broadcast on air, those women were relegated to the sidelines, almost interviewing the cheerleaders. I mean, they were just eye candy, a kind of tip of the hat. That's not the case anymore, but it was in the beginning. Did you find, as you interviewed these players and you proved your internal cred, yeah, I know who you are. I know this game like the back of my hand. I know what the stakes are in this particular game. I know what your role on this team is. When you ask questions from that point of view, they started looking at you differently, taking you seriously.
Yes, the players were very good for most part. I mean, there was always in any clubhouse, usually utility players, interestingly, who wanted to stand out by making me the butt of jokes, etc. It was, I think, a way for them to be noticed. But the stars of the team, the Thurman Munson, Reggie Jackson, the stars of that time, they were fine. I mean, they were good. They were fine with me. It was more the sports writers who were just so fearful, as you said earlier, that if one woman showed up, You know, as one of the PR directors in Boston said to Diane Shaw when she actually did show up in 1972 and found that even after she got her male editor and male lawyer at the magazine to get her the credentials she needed to be able to go into the press box and onto the field with the reporters, even when she did that, she discovered that they would not allow her to eat with the male sports writers. They set up a picnic table on the roof of Fenway Park with a sign on it that said Ladies Pavilion. That's how scared they were. And Bill Crowley, who was the older, curmudgeonly PR guy at that point, she approached him to introduce herself when she was in the press box. She said, "You see, nothing bad has happened. You know, this is all working out." And he said, "Well," he said, "tomorrow," he said, "it will happen." He said, "Tomorrow there'll be 50 of you up here trying to get at my players, my players." That was the feeling. And she reminded him there weren't even 50 of us in existence. He said, "Oh, well, they will be. They'll say they are so they can get at my players." That was the notion that we were there somehow for nefarious purposes, that we were going to be temptresses, you know, that we were going to change the tenor. And in fact, we did. They were right to fear that. Once you had the women in, just like in politics, when the women joined the boys on the bus, coverage changed. Accountability came in. There was coverage of things that happened in their personal lives, etc. So things do change. So they were right, perhaps, to fear it. But anyway,
So
that's.
in 19 at the 1977 World Series, because you've been covering baseball, because you had laid the groundwork for your own credibility, you got and because you did the work with the Yankees and the Dodgers, you got permission to be in their locker rooms from the teams. The Yankees knew you. They said yes. The Dodgers didn't because they were playing from LA. And you went, I think, to the manager whose name, Tommy John.
No, Tommy Lasorda was the manager, but
Excuse me.
he blanched when I said it, and he turned me over to Tommy John, who
Who was
was
the
the player.
player's rep? The
You're right,
player's
two
rep.
Tommies.
So Tommy John, he saw no problem with it, but he said, I have to ask the players. He went to the players. They voted. It wasn't unanimous. The majority, however, said, okay, not a problem. She can come into the locker room. So you were set. You were set
I thought I was.
until the fifth inning of the first game. Then what happened?
Well, I was sitting in what they would make in the grandstands, a sort of, you know, additional press box, because for the World Series, especially a New York Dodgers one, there wasn't room in the regular press box. So I was sitting down in that one, and they had sort of a creaky little loudspeaker on one of the poles that was set up behind us. And you know, they give it to, so if there was a scorers, you know, scored an error or something, they would tell you from the press box. So at one point, I kind of hear what I think is my name over the loudspeaker. And actually, Roger Angel from the New Yorker is sitting next to me. I say, "Roger, was that my name?" And he said, "Well, they'll repeat it. Let's listen." And so they repeated it, and I heard my name very clearly, and I had to go up to the press box. And you know, Mike, the odd thing is, I didn't really think at that point that this was something that was related to the clubhouse. I didn't know why I was there, but I did get up there, and through a series of conversations I then had, the commissioner would not speak to me, even though I asked to speak to him directly since it was his edict. But his lieutenant, who was the head of media relations for the league, said to me, he said, "You know, it doesn't matter if the Yankees gave you permission. It doesn't matter if the Dodgers gave you permission. It certainly doesn't matter if the baseball writers gave you permission with a credential that said you have access to the clubhouse. The only person who could possibly give you permission is the Commissioner of Baseball, Bowie Kuhn, and permission was never granted." And then
And
he
Bowie
added,
Kuhn was God. His word was final.
You know, in baseball, it actually was. They had an antitrust exemption. The best interests of baseball were put in his authority, and he ruled with an iron fist. After the Black Sox scandal in 1919, 1920, when they first got a commissioner, they got a judge, and he insisted on absolute authority. And that became the law of baseball. So he was right. He did have the ultimate authority. And I left that press box feeling I had no appeal.
Right.
And
There
so
was no
back to
appeal.
the drawing board we go. You know, I'm
So
just going to have to continue my gradualist, kind of process here.
I want to talk about how you think Bowie Kuhn arrived at his decision in a moment, but more importantly, I want to talk about what it meant. Is this a question that was asked then? I'm going to ask it now. Why is it important for a sports writer, male or female, to go into the locker room? And would it be just as effective if everybody had been barred from the locker room, but you had access to the players at some point? Why is it important?
I'm going to kind of back into my answer only by saying that eventually we do end up in a federal courtroom arguing this.
Right.
And I want it to be really clear that when we went into that federal courtroom, we could not and would not ask the judge to provide us, me in particular, with access to the locker room. That was not something that a federal judge could do with a privately owned and privately run business. The only thing that she could rule on, if my lawyer was successful, was on my 14th Amendment protection of the Equal Protection Clause. And she could say, we can't make the policy, Mr. Commissioner, or Yankees or Dodgers, but whatever policy you make, you must make it equal for those who are credentialed to cover the game. So that's the only premise that we could be ruled on. And so the same thing applies. You're absolutely right, Mike. If the Yankees said, no, we will not have the interviews in the clubhouse, the tradition was to have them in the clubhouse. It wasn't my choice, not Sports Illustrated's choice. That was baseball's choice. But yes, of course, they could say, all right, we're going to bar everyone from the clubhouse. And that would be equal access. So that was the premise. That was the legal decision. That was what we asked for.
But tell me how you and anybody who was barred from the clubhouse were disadvantaged by that.
Okay. Let me say, for example, that inside the clubhouse, let's take the Yankees clubhouse. There is a locker room and there is a manager's office. And then there were seven other rooms, all off limits to reporters. You would go into the locker room and you would then, in that locker room, it was not only getting a quote from an individual player as though they had brought that player out to just sort of talk to you. You heard the back and forth going on. And I will tell you, for anyone who's old enough to remember, the New York Yankees in 1977 were a soap opera of players. So you can argue that you'd write about what happened on the field, but for you to understand the dynamics of that team, you had to understand the human dynamics that went on. They were on display in the clubhouse. So if you were not there, you wouldn't know if Reggie yelled across the locker room, right? You wouldn't know.
It would lessen the impact of your story, the completeness of whatever you wrote, but because you weren't there. Melissa Ludke is our guest. Her book is called Locker Room Talk, A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside. We're going to come back and talk about this court case that resulted in everybody getting inside. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Melissa Ludke, sports journalist and author of Locker Room Talk, A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside. She will be at Park Road Books tonight signing that book and talking about it with you at 6:30 in the Park Road Shopping Center. When Howard Cosell interviewed Bowie Kuhn about this, his decision not to let you into the locker room. Here's what Bowie Kuhn told him. He said, "This is not a fair thing for our players. There is an area. This is an area where they are dressing, and it's an area where we think they're entitled to some reasonable privacy. We don't think it's fair for the rest of the press, and we also don't think it's fair to a lot of our fans who would have great reservations about this." And then Cosell asks, "Not on fair grounds of sexual privacy?" And Kuhn responds, "Yes, I think they would feel that the players are entitled to sexual privacy." What was your reaction then? What is your reaction now to that?
I never understood what Kuhn meant by sexual privacy. I mean, I certainly wasn't invading anyone's sexual privacy. Let's be clear. There's a little bit of history that we should just note. Before me, there were women who came and went from baseball. No one stayed around long enough as I did to kind of put up with it and see it through. But you know, women were excluded from being at batting practice. They were excluded from the press box. They were excluded from eating with the male sports writers. They were excluded from the baseball galas that were held, the annual dinners. My predecessor at Sports Illustrated was evicted from the baseball annual writers' dinner. She was then assigned to the baseball beat at SI. So let me just ask your listeners, does anyone think that anyone was naked or that I would be invading or women would be invading the sexual privacy of the men in any of those locations? It was about exclusion. It was not about nudity. It was not about sexual privacy. It's just that when I arrived, the last bastion was the clubhouse. That was where the battle had to take place by that point, because the other ones had by then been reluctantly open to the very few women who decided to stop by for a game or two.
And that battle then proceeded into the courtroom. This is interesting to me because it was Time Incorporated, the owner at the time of Sports Illustrated, that decided to file a complaint on your behalf with the Southern District Court in Manhattan. This is a famous court. It's a powerful court. It's the one dealing with Trump. Did that surprise you? I mean, how many other professional sports, how was that met by the professional sports machine that Time Incorporated would come to your defense?
Well, let's remember this was an era in the 1970s when a lot of issues were resolved in court, and a lot having to do with gender at that time. Time Inc. itself had been taken to court by its women in the beginning of the 70s over gender discrimination for the hiring, the pay, and promotion of women within their company. They had signed a conciliation agreement at that point without admitting any fault. It was a lovely turn of phrase. We have no fault, but we'll say that we'll sign the agreement. So by that point, that agreement's in place. And so if they're going to live up to their agreement that they're going to treat gender as a as an issue that they want equality within their ranks, so that if they need to send me to cover baseball, I'll have the same treatment by baseball as a man. If that's what they're going to do, they have to live up to it. And so, in fact, I believe that in large part, or at least in some part, they were driven by that. But I also feel that the man at the top, Roy Terrell at the time, was the managing editor. And I think that made a lot of difference because he basically, as I understand it, never said it to me, but I was told by the baseball editor that when he went in with the conundrum that I was facing at that point, Roy Terrell said, "You do what you have to do." And so began negotiations with baseball. It was only when those negotiations failed that they came to me and said, "We're going to file a suit. Would you put your name on as a plaintiff?" And perhaps naively, I said yes, thinking that it was just a suit about me wanting to do my job. I'd had no concept of, you know, sort of the hurricane, to speak of a topic very near and dear to people's hearts here. But this was a hurricane of verbal abuse and harassment that I would face for the next few months by becoming the plaintiff in this very well-known case.
So this case went to trial, but it wasn't a jury trial. It was summary judgment. It was a bench trial, meaning that the judge was going to hear both sides and make a decision on the outcome. And you ended up with a judge that they pulled out of a box. This is how it works, evidently, and we've seen that in Florida. Eileen Cannon is the Trump judge in Florida because they pulled her name out of a box.
Absolutely.
She was next up in rotation. And you got, yours was a case of firsts. It was the first case of its kind tried before the first black woman to ever sit on the federal bench. The judge you got was Judge Constance Baker Motley. But you point out that she, as you've said earlier in this conversation, her decision couldn't open doors. She couldn't make baseball do anything.
That's right.
They were a private company. It boiled down to the Constitution and your constitutional rights and the potential violation of your rights under the 14th Amendment. What does the 14th Amendment say?
The 14th Amendment, as we know, was passed after the Civil War. It was to give equal protection to those who were freed from slavery at the time. It was meant to bring about changes in the protections that Black citizens at that point would have. We were moving into Reconstruction. So that was its genesis. And through the years, and with the extraordinary assist of RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, starting in 1970, she began taking cases through the court system to the Supreme Court. At first, she was laughed at, literally laughed at, because she would bring women plaintiffs and she would argue that under the 14th Amendment, gender should be treated as an equal protection. And it was only when she started understanding that she had to bring male plaintiffs and argue that they had been discriminated against, that she would get the attention of the judges to be taken seriously. So it took her a number of years, but it wasn't until 1976, 1 year before we file our case, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg succeeded in getting the U.S. Supreme Court to raise the judicial scrutiny of gender, not as high as race, which has the highest judicial scrutiny, but to what's called an intermediate scrutiny. That was as gender then was moved up. And Constance Baker Motley, you mentioned that she was the first Black woman to sit on the entire federal bench in our country's history. Southern District Court of Manhattan not only is a well-known court, but is the mother court of our country, only court founded before the Supreme Court. In its history, at that point of 189 years, she was the only woman, Black or white, to ever sit on that district court. She was appointed in 1966 by Lyndon Johnson. I get there in 1977. Her name is put into that wooden box. She is still the only woman on that court. So not only historically first Black woman in the country, but only woman on that sitting on that court. So that's who I draw.
It was your attorney, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, who decided that's how he wanted to argue the case, that it was a violation of your 14th Amendment rights, and the right to do your job was a technical violation of the Constitution. How did he arrive at that successful strategy?
Well, the strategy was a two-point strategy. The main thing that he had to argue, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but there's something called the state action doctrine. So if you are suing entities that are private, as the Yankees were, as baseball was, et cetera, you have to prove to the court, in this case to the judge, that there is what they call the entwinement of a government agency, a city, a state, et cetera. So I'm sitting in the back of the courtroom and I'm listening to my attorney. And he's talking about some parking garage in Delaware. And I'm saying, what does a parking garage in Delaware have to do with a clubhouse in Yankee Stadium? That was the crux of the state action doctrine, because that case involving racial discrimination in a restaurant in a parking garage in Delaware went to the Supreme Court and was decided in 1961. It was called Burton v. Wilmington Parking Authority. So here's the kicker to this little story I've just told. Every time that a racial discrimination case went to the Supreme Court in the 60s, the NAACP, Legal and Education Defense Fund, assigned an attorney because they knew how to argue the Supreme Court cases. The NAACP attorney assigned to the Burton case, Constance Baker Motley. She was working for the NAACP. She had taken 10 cases of her own to the Supreme Court when she dismantled the Jim Crow system of racial discrimination in the South. She was the co-counsel on that case. No one knew that case better than Constance Baker Motley did. She had basically counseled the attorney from Delaware who handled that case. So
your life is becoming more charmed by the moment in this conversation.
Absolutely.
But people who were not around then, or maybe have forgotten, have to understand that this case, well outside of baseball, was a topic of conversation everywhere, even if you didn't follow baseball at all, didn't know anything. This was a conversation everywhere. And I remember reading and hearing reaction to this in the media, among professional athletes, among commentators, among people not connected with sports. You were the brunt of jokes on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson when The Tonight Show was really important and Carson was the king. You were the brunt of jokes on Saturday Night Live. What did that feel like? How did you react to that? How did you live through that? That most people don't have to endure that.
You know, I didn't react well. And when I talk to college students today, as I often do, because they're interested in this history now, I tell them that, you know, I warn them not to make the mistakes I did. I really failed myself in the sense that I didn't reach out as I should have to very trusted friends and sort of offload the sort of frustration. The sort of mockery really got under my skin, so to speak. I just didn't have the strength internally to be able to take it all in as a 26-year-old. And I made a really, really critical mistake. I reached for what I thought was a safety net or a safe harbor. A man I had just met soon after my case was solved, was filed, was also a sports writer. And within 3 weeks of knowing this man, he asked me to marry him. And I said, yes. Now, I wouldn't have done that if I was in my quote unquote right mind, but I wasn't. I was being reading things that just weren't me. It wasn't who I was. It wasn't why I was in this suit.
I mean, you were the topic of conversations on radio talk shows, on television talk shows, cartoonists had a feel, and cartoons, newspapers were important. Cartoons in the newspaper were almost more effective than all the words being printed in the, and you were the topic of them. They even hinted at your moral deficiencies for wanting to go into that locker.
Well, no, I lost. Mike, I lost big time in the court of public opinion. There is no case. You know, the baseball took out the old playbook. We talk about the playbooks. Well, first of all, you sexually objectify the woman. You turn her into a sexual object, so you take away her power or her agency. They did that very well by making me sort of the vixen, the temptress. They then... basically used a lot of sexual puns in whatever stories were written about me. The adjectives they used to describe me in terms of how I would go about something. I have a piece that's right in front of me now that was written by a Detroit columnist. And basically, I was out in Detroit doing a baseball story, and he has me wiggling my little finger at Mark the Bird Fidrich. He has me sashaying around some of the Tigers. And he says, I'm asking pertinent little questions. He then really upset me because he says, I can only wonder if the highly reputable Melissa accepted any of the various invitations, mostly for drinking and carousing from the Tigers. I mean, come on, right? I mean, I am there because I love baseball. I love my job. I do a damn good job of doing it. I'm learning it. I'm respecting the game. I'm respecting my elders. I'm doing it gradually. I'm not demanding. I'm asking. And you want to treat me as though I am some alien creature, you know, who you want to make in your cartoons, you know, buxom and all these things. And I wasn't at the time. But, you know, you want to create this caricature of me. And so what I did is I just retreated. I retreated into myself. And it was a huge mistake. A huge mistake.
You say you lost in the court of public opinion, but you won the case. You won the case in the real courtroom. Yep. And I have 2 minutes left. So let me ask a couple, two very important questions, at least in my opinion. In 1970, this all happened in 1977 and 1978. Those of us who lived through that and understood somewhat, we could never be in your shoes, I suppose. But it took you 10 years. You waited this long to write the book, and it took you 10 years once you decided to write the book to write it. What took so long?
I had a lot of documents to go through. My lawyers, it turned out, kept five huge legal boxes full of documents in which I like found letters that I had given them that young girls had written me. That was really my support system to get these letters, you know, delivered to me at Sports Illustrated. And, you know, those were sort of the things that sustained me. It took me years to go through all my documents. I gave away my collection of documents that I had from the case to the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe at Harvard. And so I visited my documents for a long time. I read every single story that had been written about me. I read every affidavit. I read every deposition. I read the court transcript. I really went back and researched this. I talked to people. And then I took a little time out to do a book with my daughter for a couple of years because it was the time for us to do this book with her together. Anyway, it took me a while, and then I'm a slow writer. So what can I say? I just want to tell your people who are in Charlotte here that I will be speaking tonight with a great friend of mine and a great friend of theirs, Mary C. Curtis. She will be the moderator for my event tonight. And Mary C. Curtis and I go back, and we're both journalists. So I hope that people, if they love Mary as I do, want to turn out to hear her pick up where Mike has left off here.
You say that even though you won and you went through all this yourself and you endured all of this, the picture is also still not rosy in the field of sports writing. I literally have 30 seconds. What improvements need to happen?
Well, there need to be more openings and more support, I think, for women who come into this business. What we find is that women come into it at roughly the same rate as the men, but they leave for a variety of reasons. I don't have time to get into them, but misogyny on social media could be one of them. Just a hint.
Could be.
Yeah.
Melissa Luedtke is a sports journalist. Her book is called Locker Room Talk: A Woman's Struggle to Get Inside. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.